Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, we are in celebratory mood this month on the Pubs, Pints, People podcast. I'm Simon, and here with me is regular host Claire, and this time we also have someone you won't have heard on the pod before, even though he's been with us since the very first episode.
Yes, David King has been our executive editor driving the whole project behind the scenes, and it's no exaggeration to say that without him there'd be no Pubs, Pints, People, and we wouldn't be here making the 46th, can you believe it, 46th episode. So we'd like to say a big thank you to you, David, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Claire, for that a very kind introduction, rather flattering, but executive editor, that sounds very grand. Actually, the eagle-eared may have heard me in the podcast from Series 1, Episode 11, when I interviewed Angela and Gary Morton at the Wolverhampton Micropub during the pandemic. I've been looking after the audio versions of What's Brewing and Beer for a few years, through which I got involved with mixing and editing the camera podcasts. So here I am, and it's exciting to be one of the voices this month.
Great, thanks, David. Well, the theme of this 46th episode is celebratory brews, which ties in nicely with a rather special celebration coming up very soon, of course, as it is the Platinum Jubilee year of Her Majesty the Queen. With an extra bank holiday thrown in for good measure, cue the drum roll, the national anthem, and of course a toast, at which point please make sure you have a pint in your hand to say, "Cheers, Your Majesty."
And I'm sure Her Majesty wouldn't mind at all if you say cheers a number of times, because it is an extra long weekend. And Canberra's currently running its Summer of Pub campaign to encourage everyone to head down to their local, pick a spot in the sun, remembering that it's a bank holiday weekend and they've changed the days of it, so that's confusing, but the sun might not know that and it might not come out anyway, and enjoy some of Britain's finest beer fresh from the pump. Most camera members probably don't need much encouragement, especially now that social restrictions are, hopefully and thankfully, a thing of the past.
And there are special events linked to the campaign, and if you go to the website summerofpub.camera.org.uk, you'll see all of them on a handy map. As for the Jubilee weekend, there's something extra special. Canberra's teamed up with the people organising the Jubilee weekend celebrations to promote and distribute the special Jubilee beer called Thank Brew to pubs and clubs across the country, as well as lots of special events.
You can find your nearest venue serving the beer on the map. All the details are in the show notes if you didn't make a note of the website. I'll just give that to you one more time. It's summerofpub.camera.org.uk. The proceeds from sales of Thank Brew are going back to charitable causes, which is perhaps an extra incentive to try this new and limited edition beer. No excuses needed to raise a glass to Her Majesty, of course, and her 70 years of service. The beer is a 3.5% ABV pale ale created by Fergus Fitzgerald of Adnams.
Yes, I spoke to Fergus, along with Christian Barden, who's an advisor to an organisation called the Good Beer Co. So I started by asking Christian all about the Good Beer Co.
The concept's relatively simple. It's to make it easy to enjoy good beer and support a good cause that you care about. And the Good Beer Co. was founded by our learned friend James Grugin, based down in Australia, who's got ties between Australia and the UK. And it's all about sort of good causes, good brewers, good businesses and good beer drinkers to do as much good as possible. So it's very much, he was ahead of his time, you could almost argue. It's a social enterprise. enterprise beer company, and he raises funds and awareness for the good causes around the world. So it's a great concept, and it's something that sort of Fergus and I have on board with in order to help this particular campaign, which is Thank Brew.
Let's move on to introduce Fergus Fitzgerald from Adnams. You've actually come up with the recipe for this special beer to celebrate the Jubilee and to be the Good Beer Co's special beer for this year, Thank Brew. Tell me a little bit about the Thank Brew beer.
Well, I guess that the premise is really to try and make it as easy as possible for everybody. So usually we'd have a very specific recipe that you use these specific malts, you use this yeast and you use these exact hops. But for this recipe, because we want so many people to get involved and we don't want people going out trying to find the latest sort of fashion hop, we want people to get involved as easily as possible. So actually everyone can do this and there's no excuses not to be able to brew it.
So the concept here is that brewers up and down the country will be able to brew this beer. It's not just an Adnams creation or an Adnams beer, because I know you collaborate a lot with other breweries anyway, but this is more than that sort of collaboration, isn't it?
Yes, and I guess it's a little bit inspired by the beer for Ukraine, where actually there was a recipe that everyone can get involved in. So we wanted to do the same thing. We will brew our version, but we also want other people to brew their version. So everyone gets to put a little stamp of their own on it. We'll use mostly some of the newer UK hops in our recipe, but some of those hops are hard to get. They're not plentiful. So we've tried to make the recipe that we shared with everybody something that they can sort of tweak and make their own, really.
Now, I'm sure, Fergus, you know as well as I do that if beer is brewed to a different recipe, even if, for example, a different water supply or anything slightly different, brewed in a different building, beer drinkers will at least say they notice. And if Thank Brew is being brewed all over the place but badged everywhere, will the die-hard beer drinkers need to go to every single pub in the country to make sure that they've tasted every different possible version of it?
That's a fantastic idea, Claire. That's what people should absolutely do. They should go and find this beer at every pub they can find over that bank holiday weekend, because it will taste different. So, as you say, Claire, obviously the sort of raw materials we talk about, like, you know, the hops and the malt, they obviously, people know they change the flavour, but things like water and yeast have a huge impact on flavour, and even the shapes of vessels, the height of a vessel, whether it's an open fermenter or a closed pressurised vessel, all those things will change how the beer actually comes out. So I think that's a great idea, Claire. I fully endorse people going around the country to try and find as many different variations of Thank Brew as they can.
Well, Christian, I think it will be quite easy to find lots of different varieties of Thank Brew, because I imagine quite a few pubs are very keen to get involved in this campaign.
Yes, we've had tremendous traction so far. Pub companies as big as Punch pubs putting their support behind this, as well as a number of some of the big name breweries, you know, from Adnams, as well as working with the Big Drop for the 0.5% alcohol variant that we've got. So the intention is to have a minimum of 70 breweries involved. 70 obviously falls in line with the Jubilee, and then in a perfect world, sort of over 5,000 pubs, which is kind of about 10% of the UK's pub and bar outlets.
That would be fantastic. Over 70 breweries. I mean, I know there are hundreds of breweries around the country, but could any brewery take part? So, for example, they don't have to be big breweries, whether it's Adnams size or somebody just brewing in a shed in their garden kind of thing. So it's really something that you want lots of people involved with, isn't it?
It is something that we'd like every brewer to, where they have the means to be involved, to do so. And of course, with 3,000 breweries in the UK, then there's a wealth of opportunity for people to get involved. And of course, this is, Fergus touched on it beautifully, this is all about bringing communities together. So it's not just in the local pub, it's not just the local brewery, but of course, it also extends to pub chains, it also extends to street parties and the big Jubilee lunch, etc. So for breweries and pubs to get involved, then it's www.thegoodbeerco.co.uk. Follow that through to Thank Brew, where you can download Fergus's tremendous recipes, which in turn is where pubs can log their interest and download information and point of sale for promoting the event in their pubs. And what I should say as well is, and we've only just found out today, that there's a record 50,000 people have already registered to host a big Jubilee lunch, which links with this campaign. And that there is a record number of 15 million people people expected to attend a big Jubilee lunch over that long weekend as well. So we're connecting both the on-trade and the off-trade together to bring a unique experience and a fantastic opportunity.
That's fantastic. And I imagine that just sort of getting the collateral, if you like, out there, the pump clips, everything that is going to promote this beer, that must be a huge task as well.
A huge task, but taking care of the joys of the digital era that we live in, that these things are downloadable as part of those pub POS packs or the brewery POS packs as well. So it allows you to kind of move fast and also make sure that the brand is out there promoting the good cause and saying a big thank brew.
So, Fergus, we've talked a bit about the alcohol version of the beer, if I can call it that, the 3.5% version, I think it is. But you've also worked with Big Drop, not that far away from Adnams, just down the A12 in Ipswich. And tell me about how that's come about.
Yeah, well, we know Big Drop really well. When the idea that came out that we also wanted a non-alcoholic version of the same beer, rather than ask every individual brewery to try and make a non-alcoholic version, which for some brews will be much more challenging than others, we thought actually that was probably the beer that we should centralise. We should find someone who's really good at making that. And although Adnams do make a 0.5, I didn't want this to be the Adnams roadshow. It is meant to be about bringing people together. So knowing that Big Drop makes some excellent 0.5 beers, I gave them a call and actually they jumped on board, you know, really wholeheartedly, really quickly. So so they're going to brew the 0.5 beer that will be available for everybody. And there are obviously lots of events as well who don't want to have alcohol at their event for whatever reason, but they will. So this beer will then be available for them as well.
Big Drop are a specialist brewery in this market. I imagine, though, that if they're doing the whole lot for the whole country, that's going to be a big ask, isn't it? It's a lot of capacity they'll need.
It is, we hope it will be the largest 0.5 brew for charity the country's ever seen. So we need as many pubs and as many people organising events to get onto the website and register interest, and they can start ordering that beer. So Big Drop have a good idea of how much beer to brew.
And one more thing about the recipe, but how do you know that they're going to get it right, basically?
Well, I guess we know the quality of the breweries that are signing up. So I've got every faith that people can make a really quality beer. But as long as they've got a beer that brings people together, whether one beer is a bit hoppier or a bit darker or a bit more astringent than another, then I think as long as it's bringing people together, that's really the main focus of it.
Christian, we touched on there with Fergus about the charities involved, and that really is key to the whole thing, isn't it? The thank brew, the weekend, even to a certain extent, the summer of pub, recognising volunteers and supporting charities. But that's a key element.
Hugely important. And it kind of links three core charities. There's the Together Coalition, there is the Eden Project Communities, and then there's Reset, which is about communities and refugees who are homing refugees from the Ukraine into the UK as we speak. And so the sort of, how should I say, the collaboration of what we're doing with the beer and the breweries and the hospitality sector is also benefiting the capital collaboration of three charities that are really intrinsically linked in doing well for local communities and building local communities, bridging divides in local communities to create a kinder and more connected environment.
So get out there this weekend and have a beer. Let us know how you got on. Let us know at Pubs Pints People on Twitter with pictures and stories. Keep an eye on Insta as well, because we'll be posting a selection of the best. We have a Facebook page, and of course we're interested in any royalty themed beers, ciders or stories. Maybe you could send a selfie with a beer and a royal, if you know any, or just a very special beer that you've been saving for a celebration like this. We'll watch out across all our social media platforms for all your pictures. And I don't know whether you've had any celebratory, royal, special beers, guys, that you'll be drinking this weekend.
I haven't this year, but at the risk of embarrassing myself, I'm one of these people who buys a commemorative bottle of something and then never quite gets around to drinking it because it's special. And so I kind of save it. And I've been to the back of the cupboard, and as I say, at the risk of embarrassing myself, I found a bottle of M&B beer celebrating Wolverhampton's 1,000th year. That was from 1985. And the one that's even more embarrassing, a Holden's bottle here called Prince's Pleasure, commemorating the royal wedding on the 23rd of July 1986.
Wow, that's probably worth something.
You reckon? I think it's probably sour inside, thinking of what happened. But if anybody thinks they're of value and they think it could help a charity, I'd be happy to donate them.
I've also got a few beers stashed away on my beer shelf of bottles that were brewed for special occasions and have never been opened. Mainly to do with football, though, but and I can't reach them to tell you the dates, but they're probably of a similar vintage, I would reckon.
Oh, makes me feel better.
More up to date, though, I have been trying Robinson's Queen's Tipple, a bottle of which I picked up in a supermarket because I thought, you know, if they've brought it out, especially for the Jubilee, you've really got to try it.
Mm. Gosh, well, there's no way I can compete with David's rather special sounding beers. But when I moved house back in March, it was a good chance to clear out my beer stash under the stairs. And in amongst it, I found some bottles of Fuller's Vintage Ale, including some doubles. So over the Jubilee weekend, I think I'll be tucking into a bottle of the 2015 Fuller's Vintage Ale.
I do fancy trying this Thank Brew, though. That sounds really good. Now, as with all the episodes this season, we're on tour around this great nation of ours. And this time we're in Glasgow, which is seeing the return of its Real Ale Festival, all happening on the 16th to the 18th of June. Most of us go to beer festivals and are served beer and cider in excellent condition, and I'm sure camera members would expect nothing less. In this season of podcasts, we've been getting a real insider's look at beer festivals, and today we're going to hear from a festival steward.
Well, you might actually wonder, what does a festival steward do? Well, don't worry, because we've got one here to tell you all about it. Let's just say it's a vital and largely unsung role. Obviously, they're the first port of call for visitors to a festival. They keep everyone safe throughout the duration of the festival and do whatever is needed to keep the show on the road. Remember, all camera festivals are run by volunteers, and that includes the stewards. Walter Ross is one such volunteer festival steward at the Glasgow Real Ale Festival, and I spoke with him earlier, so here he is to give us the lowdown on his role and experience as a steward. Walter, some of us only ever attend festivals as customers, so what's it like being on the other side of the fence and volunteering for a camera festival?
It's actually a very rewarding experience. As I say, over the years, I've been volunteering now at festivals for about 30 years, and over that time I have met a lot of very, very good friends, so I find it very rewarding.
30 years, that's a very long time, so what sort of roles have you held as a volunteer in that period?
Majority of the time I have been stewarding. I've done a couple of other jobs at festivals as well. I have helped out on the bars in times, and I have worked on glasses and reception and other work as well. But majority of the work has been stewarding.
Okay, and just thinking about that role as a steward, what would a typical few days as a volunteer steward look like? What sort of issues do you get called to deal with, and what sort of challenges are you presented with?
Hopefully a festival you don't have a lot of challenges. Everybody behaves themselves, everything goes as it should be. You can have a very successful festival in terms of a stewarding point of view. A typical steward's duties is normally at the front door, you're greeting the customers as they arrive, and it's always good to have a cheerful face when people arrive. Within the festival itself, it's mainly just sort of keeping an eye on things, making sure everybody's enjoying themselves. Obviously dealing with any issues that arise, things like broken glasses, things like that.
Are there any particular qualifications you need to have, or do some of the stewards hold an SIA or other licensing?
A number of the stewards do have an SIA, Security Industry Authority license, as door supervisors. But as a camera steward, you don't necessarily need to have that license. There's lots of different jobs that stewards can do that don't necessarily need to have the license to do.
And just thinking in terms of the Glasgow Festival that's coming up, so how many volunteers make up the stewarding team?
We'll have about 8 volunteers on the stewarding team during the 4 days. They won't all be there at the same time, but they'll be there at different times.
And what sort of shifts would you typically work?
Stewards can actually be a long shift for stewards. In general, for most festivals, stewards are usually the first people there and the last people to leave, because we're going to be there before everybody else to get everything set up and control entry. And again, We're usually there at the end. There's no fixed hours. The whole thing is people work the hours that they can work because it is a volunteer. But there are people who will be there from, you know, sort of 10 o'clock in the morning up till 11 o'clock, half past 11 at night, once everything's all tidied off.
Obviously, we're speaking about your role at Glasgow today, but do you volunteer at any other beer festivals across Scotland or even further afield?
Oh, yes, I volunteer at festivals across the UK, basically. We do sort of typical year, well, certainly not in the last few years, but sort of prior to everything I was probably doing between 6 and 7 festivals a year.
Of those, I guess it's a similar sort of role across each one, similar sort of challenges, or is there anything that's stood out from your experiences as a steward over the years at the different festivals?
Every festival is different. Every festival's got its different challenges. You know, one of the festivals I do is Cambridge, which is an outside festival. You know, so it's a tented festival outside, which is a different stewarding technique to what you would use in something like Great British Beer Festival at Olympia.
I haven't been to Cambridge myself, but I've been to the Ealing Beer Festival, and that's always outdoors in a park in a couple of large marquees. As a customer, it's a completely different experience, and when you get good weather, there's nothing better than enjoying the beers that are on offer.
That's the thing. The good weather makes an outdoor festival. If you have weather, whether it's a little bit inclement and raining, and it can sort of have its own challenges in an outside festival.
My sense is that a big part of volunteering is the camaraderie that you get from working with others and the social side of things. So how do the volunteers unwind at the Glasgow Beer Festival?
At the end of the night, we'll sort of get together, have a chat, maybe have a beer before everybody goes off home. Usually at the end of the festival itself, there's usually a sort of kind of a staff party. Everybody just sort of unwind when everything's finished, you know.
And I guess that's a chance to drink any of the beers that are left, or do you tend to have staff bars as well at some of the larger festivals?
Some of the larger festivals will have a dedicated staff bar area, but most of the sort of smaller regional festivals, usually just a selection from the main bar that staff would get, you know, either during the day. Typically when you're stewarding, especially if you've got your SIA license, you're not actually drinking until the end of the evening when everybody's out and officially off duty.
Yeah, that's quite a different experience from, I guess, if you're volunteering behind the bar. My experience is I've seen some volunteers who are able to sample the beers that they're serving, but I suppose when you're in a security role, it calls for a different approach as a volunteer.
Yes, that's it. You know, as I say, we've got to deal with people we can't really be seen to be drinking ourselves. I also cover first aid as well at some festivals. So again, for that role, drinking before doing anything isn't advisable, you know.
Just thinking in terms of anyone who's thinking of attending the Glasgow Beer Festival during June, do you have any top tips for them or things to look out for, or any, you know, secrets from behind the scenes that you'd like to share?
The main thing with the festival, it can get busy. Most festivals is limited seating at, so be prepared to stand for a little while because not always going to be seats available. If you can pre-purchase tickets, that's a good way of making sure you can get in.
I was looking on the festival website before we spoke. It looks like there'll be a great range of beers, but also some spirits and some wines and possibly some mead available as well. So there's a little bit of something for everyone, I guess.
Yes, I found over the years that having alternatives to beer encourages more people to stay longer, you know, especially if you get couples arriving, you get one who's into beer, one who isn't. You tend to find them they'll only stay for a few beers and leave, whereas if you've got alternative drinks for people, you know, people stay longer and it just makes a better experience for everybody.
And just thinking beyond the festival and the wider Glasgow region, if any Camera members or listeners to the podcast are planning to visit over the coming months, which, you know, pubs or tap rooms would you recommend people put on their to-do list?
There's quite a few pubs in Glasgow. One that I sort of frequent, I think, is the State Bar on Holland Street. That's a very good one. Another one's also the Bonacord in North Street. And both of these are actually fairly close to each other. They normally have a reasonable range of beer between the two pubs.
Yeah, I think we should all raise a glass to Walter and all the other fabulous volunteers who make our beer festivals happen. Because let's not forget that many beer festivals have been absent for the last 2 years and some are only just now returning. So we have links to all the Camera Beer Festivals in the show notes if you want to check out the latest information for your area. And don't forget, of course, the Great British Beer Festival is back too. That's the 2nd to the 6th of August and tickets are selling fast, so don't miss out.
Now correspondent Alison Tafts is chatting with Adam Green from Old Street Brewery, which actually started off on an incredibly small scale, but now makes amazing one-of-a-kind and great celebratory brews.
So I'm here with Adam Green. I just wondered where you are in the world.
Yep, so we are the brewery and myself, we're located in Hackneywick in East London.
So it doesn't sound like a Hackney accent you've got there, Adam. So where are you from originally?
Yeah, so definitely not from London. This is very obvious. I'm originally from Phoenix, Arizona. I've been here in London for over 6 years now.
And were you brewing before you arrived in London?
Not in any sort of commercial sense. I did, you know, home brewing sort of just on an amateur level. It wasn't really until I moved to London and saw the way the beer scene was here. It was very much still sort of not in its infancy, but it was still quite young. And it was just the thought that, you know, if there's ever a time to start a brewery, now's the time.
So tell us, how's it been? How have you sort of established yourself?
Basically bought my first brew kit in the summer of 2016 and just started home brewing, you know, 2-3 times a week, you know, spending all my money that I had on hops and grain. You know, as a lot of home brewers and, you know, commercial brewers will identify with that. It's a passion that just kind of takes over everything. You stop going on trips, you stop, you know, paying for anything else. You're just buying hops, you know, and grain. And every little piece of equipment you get your hands on. I got the opportunity from Nigel Mother Kelly's, the owner of Mother Kelly's. He had a pub under near King's Cross, the Queenside pub, and he had a little 100-liter brew kit there, gave me the opportunity to brew in there. So did that for about a year with the co-founder, Andreas. And so we just sold beer to the pub above. And then, you know, that was a great opportunity for us to kind of realize, okay, do we actually want to do this, you know, for real? And the answer was obviously yes. So we went out and, it's a weird thing, you know, trying to ask people for money because we didn't have a lot of money ourselves. We kind of landed on 50,000 pounds as the target that we need to start the brewery, which in hindsight, way too little amount of money. I would never do it again for anything less than, you know, sort of six-figure money. But, you know, the beauty of starting a company when you're, you know, don't know much about what you're doing is the naivety is a blessing. With that same brew kit, we took it out of the Greenside pub and then brought it to an archway in Bethnal Green. And then just sort of built some tables, built a little bar. And over the next couple of years, just slowly, you know, upgraded the brew kit and went from that 200 liter brew kit to we ended up buying the pressure drop, the old pressure drop kit was it early 2019. And that really changed things for us, you know, because the quality of the beer was able to go up dramatically with, you know, sort of the higher quality kit and stuff like that. And then in November 2020, we took on the Hackney Wick site, which was definitely a risk because it was the, you know, the height of the pandemic, but it was such a great opportunity. It was right next to Howling Hops Brewery, Crate, Truman's is brewing right there, very much up and coming area. And then the on-site sales there at Hackney Wick is just great. Summertime, you know, the bar is full of people, the whole area is just full. So it's allowed us to kind of relax a little bit and then focus on the wholesale and sort of, you know, focus on the quality of the beer a lot more.
Tell me, you've got some amazing looking, huge imperial stouts that look distinctly special occasion to me.
So one of the big ones we got is our pumpkin stout. So we brew that once a year. It's called 24-hour pumpkin people. But as soon as the harvest comes out, we get an entire pallet of pumpkins. You know, not your typical jack-o'-lantern pumpkin. These are you know, ones that high quality ones that you eat. And then we go, we chop up every single pumpkin, skin it, and then we chop it in small cubes. Then we put it into ovens for 30 minutes and smash it down, pour honey on top, and then cook it some more. And then we put about 300 kilos of this pumpkin into the mash with, you know, some barley and grain and oats and stuff like that. And then we do two mashes, and then we do multiple boils. So we boil, so that it'll call it 24-hour pumpkin people because it's almost a 24-hour brewing process to get this beer. And there's a reason why that we only do it once a year, because it is very time consuming to do. It's not something you can make every week, obviously. Pumpkin beers in America, you know, sort of like if you know, the pumpkin spice latte season kind of comes around October, November. In America, it's a big thing. Here in the UK, we're trying to make it a trend, but it is a bit of a struggle convincing people that pumpkin beer is good because it's loaded full of cinnamon and allspice and nutmeg, cloves and vanilla. So if you're not not familiar with these sort of pastry stouts, it is like, what the heck is going on in this beer?
I see that you've done a no figgity imperial stout as well, which looks super rich.
So we did that one with Deviant Dandy Brewery. That was one of our first collabs we ever did. And so we brewed that one twice. This last batch, we actually rum barrel aged it over at Deviant Dandy. And that one is, it was for something we brewed, Tonka Bean had just come out. You know, it hadn't just come out. It was just kind of getting on the eye of, you know, sort of the culinary beer world. And it's, Tonka Bean's amazing. I've never had it. It has very much the sort of a cinnamony sort of vanilla taste to it. So we built, you know, brewed the, you know, the big imperial stouts with a base, and then we put it was figs in there, and then obviously the name No Figgity comes from, and then put the Tonka Bean in there, and then barrel aged it for 6 months. It's one of those that, you know, so it was our first time doing any barrel aging, but you really do see what barrels can bring to a beer if it's done properly. And it really did just add a whole level of complexity being in those rum barrels as opposed to the original beer that we produced.
And you also make some really sort of big and impressive looking double IPAs, I think.
Yeah, so we, our first, I mean, we sort of always sort of made double IPAs because I love the beer style. Pliny the Elder is my favorite beer in the world. And I've never had Pliny the Younger. You know, we're talking Russian River out in California.
Yes.
It's one of those beers I've always wanted to get my hands on. But unless you're in San Francisco in February, you can't get it. It's very selective. So one of these days I'll make it out there.
Where would you sort of say those big double IPAs, where do they fit in?
For me personally, you know, Imperial Stouts, you know, big double IPAs. I typically start off, you know, if I'm going, it's a Saturday, I'll drink, I always start out with a lager. You know, lager is my favorite beer style outside of a sort of West Coast IPA. Start out there, sort of cleanse the palate, and then sort of make the way around the beer world, sort of getting those double IPAs. It's definitely not a hot summertime beer. You know, it's more of a, you know, when it's a bit colder, you know, the bigger beers, a lot more sugar, a lot more body on them. You don't want to drink it when it's 25, 30 degrees out necessarily. But the for me, as from a brewing perspective, when you get these bigger beers, what you're able to get out is a lot more flavor, you know. So nothing against pale ales and sort of these, you know, other hoppy beers. When you start getting higher ABV, the way that the alcohol interacts with the hops is where you really start to get a lot of big punchy flavors, you know, especially when you get these big hops, the Mosaic, the Citrus, the Centennials coming out of Yakima Valley. That's where you really get just a much different beer at that higher ABV. You know, big beers just have so much flavor in them.
Yeah, and I'm thinking there we've got this opportunity with food matching with these styles. Mm-hmm. What sort of meals would you suggest with those kind of big dippers?
Yeah, it's a good question because it's the, I mean, it's almost a beer that I would have after a big meal. You know, something like it's like, especially when you talk about the big stouts, they are a lot of times dessert beers, you know, so after you've had your big meal and then you kind of sip on them, you know, or sip on them throughout the meal. Me, for when I'm eating a meal, like I really like the lambics, you know, having like a nice Canteon or something, table beer during a meal. That's you know, the way that I like to go. But the big beers, yeah, they're very much just sort of like an end of the night, you know, sort of a nightcap, I think, yeah, in a lot of ways.
It sounds amazing. As I say, I'm looking forward to getting my hands on some of that. So when you're absolutely celebrating yourself, Adam, and if I say you can't drink one of your own brews, what sort of beers do you reach for to, you know, have in front of you in that, in those special occasions?
Being American and being over here in the UK, there is something about American beer for me. You know, obviously craft beer started in America, you know, sort of the late 70s, early 80s, and really took off in the mid 90s. What you get from that is the skill and the innovation that we're seeing in America is just further developed than it is in most parts of the world. But then the other place that I look for is towards Belgium. So a big fan of mixed fermentation lambic beers. And you know, the styles that these guys and girls have been doing for decades and centuries over there. And it's only the craft beer revolution that kind of turned everybody to Belgium. It's like, wow, they're making incredible beers over there consistently. And they're doing things that, you know, if somebody told me that, hey, you need to use hops like Canteon does from 1995, or, you know, before you knew what that style was, you'd look and say, why would you use 25-year-old hops? But they use these old hops and these barrel aging techniques to make absolutely special beers that you can't get anywhere else in the world. And there are a few producers here in the UK that are, they're doing a great job as well as the US, but there's nothing like a Belgian mixed fermentation beer, in my opinion. And that's, if I'm really celebrating something and I really want to get a nice bottle, that's where I'm going to go to more than anything, is those nice big lambics out of Belgium.
So you're very much Belgian influenced, and obviously you've mentioned a couple of American. Any other American brews that are great for these occasions?
Like I said before, Russian River Pliny the Elder is absolutely my favorite beer. I'm a big fan of West Coast IPA, West Coast double IPAs. But obviously the New England IPAs have really taken off in the last 4 or 5 years. And there's been, the UK beer brewing scene has been massively influenced by the New England IPAs. So you start talking about Treehouse and Trillium and The Alchemist out there in sort of just outside of Boston, Vermont sort of areas. And then there's a lot of other, you know, got Side Project over in sort of the middle of the country, making absolutely some of the best barrel-aged beers in the world. There's KC Brewing out of Glenwood Springs over in Colorado. doing some amazing mixed fermentation stuff. And really, the big thing for me, there's over 9,000 breweries now in America. So every time I go back, I realize how far behind I am in the beer scene. Always a new brewery doing something really innovative and something cool. Most of the time when I go back to the States, I'm just seeking out these really big, innovative beers to go and try them. And then to try to take those techniques, bring them back here to the UK and figure out, okay, how do we do this?
This is a really difficult question, but I always like to ask it for brewers. What is your desert island beer, Adam, if you could only take one beer with you?
Yep, I think that's got to be Augustiner. Hell's Lager, absolutely. It's just, lager is my typical day-to-day drinking beer. Not macro lager, obviously. We're talking sort of a craft or more traditional German-style lager. But if there's one beer that I was going to drink forever, it'd be Augustiner for sure.
Adam, any other advice or tips for our beer-loving friends here, especially if it's a special occasion they don't mind spending a few extra pounds?
Yeah, so I mean, I think for just the not sort of special occasion, but just in general, I think the biggest thing for a beer consumer is, this sounds a bit ridiculous, but just drink a variety of different beers. There are so many amazing beer styles out there in the world. Every time you have one of these beers, whether it's an alt beer from Dusseldorf or a Kölsch from Cologne or anywhere that really specializes in something, you can get the top quality product. You really just develop those taste buds to allow yourself to appreciate all these beers. So it's just going out, trying different beers from the best producers and just exploring everything that's out there and developing your palate.
Pumpkin stout sounds a bit more like a pudding to me, but I'm not keen on pumpkin pies and things like that either. But the pastry style, now big in the US apparently, and they say that when America has a pastry, we have a full British breakfast. So who knows what style of beer that could inspire. You don't really have to worry too much about food pairings, as Adam was saying, with these big flavoured beers. They're almost like a course on their own, like an aperitif or a dessert wine, dare I say.
And lots of brewers do look around the world for inspiration, just as Adam has with America and Belgium. And there's a lot going on wherever you go these days. Now that the world's opening up again, Camera's released a new book by the celebrated beer and travel author Tim Webb called Beer Breaks. I've got a copy, it's very good. And he's highlighting 30 different beer destinations that are easily reached from the UK.
But some people, of course, do prefer to stay more local, and quite a few have been asking Camera for UK-based ideas. As well as a handful that are in Tim's new book, we've launched a competition to get some local knowledge from our members and beyond. Anyone can enter using the book's template to propose their local beer destination and explaining why it's so special. The winner will be printed in the winter edition of Beer Magazine, and the author will receive a nice case of some of the beers featured in the book.
Well, Camera's also releasing the world's greatest beers on International Beer Day in August, with 250 of the globally best beers that are available here in the UK. They've been specially selected by a panel of 8 beer authors, influencers and experts. You can pre-order now. Details, as ever, in the show notes. And now we're moving on to our special feature of the podcast. We're only here for the beer, or possibly cider, perry and other drinks, but mainly beer. It's our regular section about pubs that we've visited and loved that you'll find in the Good Beer Guide, and possibly also pubs where we might not have been yet, but we're looking forward to visiting them. And with the Jubilee weekend in mind, I suppose perhaps pubs that we might feel appropriate to visit over this weekend. Which pubs have you been looking at? Start with you, Simon.
Sure. Well, having moved house back in March, I'm still exploring some of the pubs in my local area down here in Surrey. I'm actually hoping to visit the Old Swan in Chertsey, which, when I was looking through the Good Beer Guide, describes it as offering drinkers and diners a mellow experience with its shabby chic interior, which definitely sounds interesting. But of more note for this weekend is that the pub will be hosting a beer festival on the 3rd and 4th of June, so I'll be definitely popping along to see what they have to offer.
Well, I can top that, because I've also got a pub with a beer festival for the Jubilee weekend, but I've got one better. It's called the Queen's Head. You think that, we don't produce this stuff, but hey, we do. The Queen's Head, it's at Ersham near Bungay. It's actually in Norfolk, right on the border with Suffolk. They've got their beer festival on Saturday, the 4th of June, and they're a pub that... I think they have a couple of beer festivals a year, generally. They serve local beers like Lacons, Ampersand, Three Blind Mice. They have food trucks visiting with pizzas, burgers and so on. I've not been there yet. One of the few pubs in this part of the world that I haven't managed to get to. But I shall certainly be trying to get there, hopefully, for that beer festival.
I'm also going for a Royal-linked pub, the Royal Oak in Compton Road, Wolverhampton. It's Banks's pub, so of course Banks's Mild will be there. I do like a glass of mild myself. Royal Oak, named after, of course, the tree which is popular with hiding royals, which is in this area in Boscobel. The pub is described as bustling, with open mics on Tuesdays, live bands on Fridays and Saturdays, and raising a lot of money for local and national charities too. We've got one more interview for you. Alison Tafts is in the chair once again, and this time with Oliver Meckler, who's brewing up some very interesting stuff in the Netherlands.
Oliver, thank you very much for joining us today to talk about special brews, particularly celebration brews. But first of all, I'd love to know where you're talking to us from.
Thanks, Alison. I'm talking to you from Enschede, as you would pronounce it in the Dutch language or the Dutch slang. Everybody knows Amsterdam. It's right in the east of the country, let's say the other side of Amsterdam, right next to the German border.
So you're brewing there, aren't you? But I understand that you didn't start life as a brewer, did you? Tell us how you got into this wonderful industry.
I'm actually a winemaker and beverage technologist. I don't know if you can still hear it from my accent. I'm actually German by birth, and I studied in Geisenheim as a beverage technologist. So I lived in South Africa for 14 years, and I got into the brewing industry and also started my own company there, brewing beer, distilling whiskey, making wine, giving workshops, and so on. So I'm a trained winemaker, but also a brewer and distiller by heart.
Wow, so you really have covered all the bases there. You must have an incredible technical knowledge, which is really interesting. And what were you distilling, Oliver?
We run a company called the Koperensterre, or translated the Copper Star. And our main product is whiskey, so Dutch whiskey, which is not very common. It's fairly new on the market. We've been busy now for almost 6 years, and we're going to release our first whiskey within this year. So actually very exciting time. So that's our main product, and thereafter we also do make beer, and our special product that's we'll talk about later.
That sounds pretty exciting. I can't wait to get my hands on some of your Dutch whiskey. Is it something that is going to be exported, do you think?
Yes, we're going to export it. We are small, very crafty operation, so at the moment we're producing like 20 barrels. That is approximately 8,000 bottles a year. So we're going to start very slow with a couple of thousand bottles, but our aim is to stay small, not more than 8,000 or 10,000 bottles a year. But it will be internationally available if they don't drink it all here in the Netherlands.
I think, yeah, that's what normally happens, isn't it, with a small brewery as well. So tell us about this brewing and blendery that you're involved with.
Okay, so look, being a winemaker, I was listening to my dad. My dad always says, son, you don't need to be the best in one thing, but you need to be doing what nobody else can do. So seeing that I'm a winemaker slash later become a brewer, I had the idea of making a champagne beer. Now, champagne beer is not new. Champagne beer has been done in Belgium, it's been done for many years, but I wanted to do something really with a wine fermentation. So the start was actually in South Africa, there still as a hobby brewer before I started my own brewery, and we did 50 liters of what we call the strawberry blonde, which was a blonde ale with 20% of Cabernet grapes. And it was, to my knowledge at least, the first time that a brewer used real grapes in the beer, not just pasteurized grape juice, but real grapes. So that's where we started, and that was 15 years ago, I guess. So the last 13 years I'm now in the Netherlands. And I have a good old friend, actually, from your side of the water, Steve Gamage from the Broncos, the brewing company. And we said, we need to make a collab. And I said, let's make champagne beer. So we started a little bit bigger than 50 liters. We started with 2,000 liters. And Steve brewed the beer in his company, and I did the champagne to it.
It's fascinating when we start to get into this world of blending, winemaking and brewing. So give us a bit of a précis of how it works.
Just stop me if I'm getting into the real technical stuff. Now, we brewed 2,000 litres of a light amber ale with a more or less neutral hop bitterness. Not a really outspoken beer, just a good base beer. That was 7% alcohol. After we fermented the beer through, we put it in the cold store. Then the second step was we used the mesh tun. We added 20% in weight of Pinot Noir grapes on the skins. And that's where it becomes very special. Not pasteurized grape juice, as I mentioned before, on the skins. Al made a wine yeast starter, and we started fermenting for 6 hours. That doesn't sound long, but wine yeast is very aggressive. So after 6 hours, we pumped the fermented beer on top, and within 2 days, it was going wild in the Lotertun. And the wine yeast managed also to eat all the remaining sugars that the beer yeast didn't touch. So we get like a slightly pinkish drink, which you normally associate with sugar and sweetness, but bone dry. So that product went again in the cold store. We settled out the yeast. And in the meantime, I prepared the champagne yeast for the third fermentation. So it's first beer, then wine, then champagne. So we needed to bring up the make a yeast starter. That was done for a week. And slowly but surely, you're adding sugar to bring the alcohol level to approximately 9.5%. So the aim was to bring the yeast to the same level, so the yeast felt very comfortable. Further, we added more and more beer to it, so the yeast could also adapt to the environment beer. Day after, we had quite a large amount of yeast starter, like 150 liters, and we added to each of the champagne bottle with a syringe, added the yeast. What we added as well was sugar, and usually a beer is 1.5 bar in the pressure. In champagne beer, or also in a champagne, you want 5 to 6 bar. So we added actually 18 grams of sugar per bottle to bring it to the 5 bar. Then we put a crown cork on top, and we kept it in a warm room for approximately 4 weeks. So the yeast could ferment all the sugars in there and produce the CO2 and the pressure. So these bottles were then stacked and went into the cold store for 9 months. In these 9 months, what happens is the big beer bubbles, they were falling apart under pressure. So from a very big CO2 bubble that you see in a beer foam, in a beer bubbling, we're making very fine CO2 bubbles. In French, in the champagne, they call it a mousseux. After 9 months, we'd taken out the bottles, put it in a rack. Following the champagne process, they were riddled. They were basically turned once or twice a day for the duration of 2 weeks. So all the yeast would go down the neck and collects on top of the crown cork. Once we collected the yeast, it's approximately a centimeter of yeast layer there. So we wanted to get the yeast out. So we have an equipment that freezes it with glycol at minus 27 degrees. Now I'm getting a bit too technical, I know. At minus 27 degrees, freezes an ice block. That ice block contains the yeast. So you can turn the bottle upside down. You take off the crown cap. It gets a hell of a bang and shoots out through the whole brewery. We're shooting out the ice block with the immobilized yeast, containing the yeast, and we've got a clear product.
That's an incredibly lengthy and painstaking process that you went through there with that particular beer. And the big question, how did it taste?
Okay, look, obviously it's my baby and you love your baby no matter how it looks like. So it's only 20% of the volume of, let's say, of the ingredients is grape, but the taste is really half-half. There's a lot of elements of beer in there, but also a lot of elements in wine. So you can really taste both of the elements. Both of them are really there. And you get the feeling of the champagne, you get the bubbles, you get also the visual that mousseux. We also designed a special glass, which was like a champagne glass, but a little bit wider, so resembling a bit more like a good beer glass, like a craft beer one. And we put a little rough spot in there in order to release the bubbles, like Düffel does in their glasses.
Yes.
So you get that effervescence of the CO2 bubbles.
So with all of that trouble and time and effort, it seems certainly a beer that's suitable for a very special occasion and a big celebration, definitely. Is it commercially available, that product, Oliver, or is it just for your nearest and dearest?
It is commercially available. We're just getting our website revamped. It's the corporate sale. So it's available directly from us at the moment only, and through the company for my good old friend Steve Gamage from Bronkoster.
And what's it called, Oliver?
Basically called Symbiose, or in Dutch, or Symbiosis. And it's called, we've got three at the moment. Two are available right now, which is the Pinot Brut. That is the one with a 20% Pinot Noir. We didn't call it champagne beer because it's not, as you know from champagne, it's not allowed. But also we didn't want to. We call it the Brut. It gives you enough indication of being a champagne method. And then we also have a blonde Brut, but that is almost sold out. What we did is, instead of using actual grapes, we use grape sugar, just to give it a variation there. That is more leaning towards the beer side, and the Pinot Brut, that is really the wine side. There's a new project that I'm having, it's called the Nelson Brut. basically it's an IPA brewed with 100% Nelson Sommelier hop. It was the most expensive beer ever brewed because the hop was not available. I had to buy it from all over the country. And I added 15% of already in fermentation, the juice from the from Sauvignon Blanc from Germany, from a good friend of mine.
So what other brews have you been creating alongside these amazing champagne beers that you've been making?
Seeing that our whiskey is now starting to sell, we're getting more and more whiskey barrels available. And I started now to do barrel-aged beers, and I brewed a double bock and made an ice bock with 13.5%. So basically froze out 40% of the water. The remaining was a product with 13.5%, and that's now resting and maturing for 9 months in my first whiskey barrel, which contained Oloroso sherry, then our whiskey. Now it's the beer is in, and it will be bottled soon. And that is something, seeing that we will have up to 20 barrels of 250 liters available every year where we release the whiskey, sell the whiskey. The idea is to go into barrel aged.
Wow. So that also sounds like an incredible special occasion drink, that sort of powerful ice beer, that idea. It's a very unusual technique here in Britain, but I know it's something that gets used in Germany and other countries.
With my German background, it's obvious that I had to do that.
Absolutely. If you were going to be celebrating and you wanted to reach for a beer to celebrate, I was going to ask you which ones you choose, perhaps one of yours and perhaps something else that you've been inspired by.
It changes, like, your mood changes. But at the moment, it would be the Symbiosis Nelson Brut. That's really that wine character. It's got a little bit of the cherry in there. It's matured. And through COVID, well, it's maturing much longer. So it's really like matured and ready and, like smooth and velvety. So that would be at the moment from my own beers would I prefer. And then anything from my good old friend Steve Gamage from the Broncos, the brewing company. Give me any time, any beer from that brewing company, I will be happy to celebrate.
You've been incredibly inspiring in terms of just the lengths you go to create some what sound like amazing brews. I shall be on that website looking for a bottle right away.
We had an episode on mixed fermentations back in season 1, episode 9 to be precise, and from what Oliver says, it sounds like something we could revisit. It seems like there's still plenty of room for invention and innovation if you follow Oliver's mantra of what can I do that no one's ever done before.
I definitely feel the need to crack open some of that champagne-style beer, which really must be the ultimate celebration drink. It actually reminds me of a barrel-aged Imperial Pilsner from Camden Brewery, which comes in at a hefty 11%. And I got to sample last year. Whiskey barrels and beer also seem to be very natural partners in crime if you like a dram. It's a bit like a Scottish half and half, but of course all in one glass. I think that's whetted all of our appetites for the long weekend, and I hope it's done the same for everyone who is listening.
And before we sign off, we do just have to talk about our last orders, as we do every episode. Now, at this time in last month's episode, I said that I hadn't managed to pick a mild, but I would definitely drink a mild during May and have it as my last orders for this edition of the podcast. And so I've done just that. I tracked down Ampersand Fast Fashion. It's a 3.6% Ruby Mild. It's a vegan ale as well, and it's one of their seasonal beers. I've mentioned Ampersand on the podcast many times before, and I really liked this one, actually. I'm not used so much to Ruby Milds. I prefer the sort of darker Milds, but I really enjoyed this one, and I'm not sure that it'll still be around now that Mild Month is out of the way, but hope to see it again in another Mild Month or this time next year.
I recently had a Railway Porter from Five Points, the Hackney-based brewery. I sampled this in the Express Tavern near Kew Bridge in London. I think it comes in at around 5%, and it's a glorious example of a porter. And it was so good that it's the type of beer that once you've had the first pint, you just can't resist going back to the bar for the second.
And I'm still celebrating Mild Month, as I do all year round. I'm here in the West Midlands, so mild is a good local drink. And I'm having Pig on the Wall from Black Country Ales, 4.3%. It's described as a refreshing chestnut brown beer with a complex flavour of light hops, giving way to a bittersweet blend of roasted malt. It's named after, I think it's an occurrence in the 1800s when lots of pigs were kept in backyards and there was a procession going by and somebody put the pig up on the wall so it could see the band passing by.
I bet it's enjoyed that. But that's not a beer that I'm familiar with, but it sounds a good one.
They're a kind of growing chain across the West Midlands. They keep sort of adding another pub or two every year, but they have their own mild on throughout the year, and it's a lovely drink.
I shall look out for that one. Now, we do need to say a few thank yous before we close. Our script today, written by Mark Lavert. Also thanks, of course, to David King of this parish, Paul Hadfield and Simon Clark, as well as Simon Price, for all their help with this show. And we'll be back next month on Wednesday, the 6th of July. We'll be looking at diversity and inclusion in the beer sector. That's a really important topic that's gaining more traction all the time. We'll be talking all about it. But until then, cheers! Cheers.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How does a free case of beer sound?
Yes, you can grab a case for free, courtesy of our pals at Beer 52, by going to www.beer52.com/people, that's the numbers 52 in the 52, and covering the meagre postage cost of £5.95. And what's more, as a special offer for our listeners, they'll throw in 2 extra beers for free, so that's 10 unique craft beers.
Beer 52 is actually the biggest beer club in the world. Each month, they send their members a case of beer from a different part of the world, and this month it's an absolute belter. Their Great European Road Trip case takes in the best beers from across the continent.
So try a crisp, refreshing Pilsner from Norway's Lervig Brewery and a monster 7.5 double IPA from Sweden's Durges Brewery. On the dark side this month, there's a smooth stout from Copenhagen's Tuol. There's also beer from Croatia, Poland, Germany, Serbia and Austria, among others.
And if dark beer's not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. Also included is the ever-insightful Ferment magazine and a couple of tasty snacks. And even if, after all that, you're still unsatisfied, you can simply pause or cancel at any time.
So head over to www.beer52, that's the numbers 5 and 2, .com/people to claim your free case of 10 beers now.